We return to the first chapter of The Mother. Sri Aurobindo wrote this as a message for distribution on the 21st of February, 1927, as he's trying to congeal the group of about 24 disciples, perhaps as many as 30, around him in a one-pointed effort to bring a new consciousness into manifestation upon the earth. He and the mother were absolutely committed to this in every part of their being. And this message is written to call upwards, to inspire and to instill a will in those who were part of this collective effort. So first, the recognition that there are two powers. The power of the human aspiration represents the call of the earth for the Supreme to come to it. What answers is, of course, the grace of that Supreme. Demanding that the conditions be proper, be auspicious, not simply for an inner illumination, but this is for an instantiation in the physical of what is above. So that should manifest here, is the whole principle of this yoga. Surrender. Self-opening. Rejection. Well, in chapter 2, the whole of the material is about aspiration, rejection, and surrender. The surrender is what we begin with tonight. He's already established that. In the integrity of the offering, there must be a wholesale conflagration of the being offered into that purifying flame. It can't simply be the inner portion of us. It can't simply be the inner mind, the inner vital, or the subtle physical that experiences the afflatus from above and responds to it. It must be a surrender that reaches into the whole of the external being. We awaken these inner parts, but we have to bring that suffusing light from within into the outward parts of the nature. As he says, nothing, even the most external, can be left out. He writes, if part of the being surrenders, but another part reserves itself, follows its own way, or makes its own conditions, then each time that that happens, you are yourself pushing the divine grace away from you. So it's an integrality that he's looking for. We can't operate in one part of our being, simply be a bhakta, or a jnanin, or a karma yogin. We must be all three, and the entirety of the being must be involved in it. Entire means entire. So you can imagine that the 30 people that are around Mother and Sri Aurobindo are receiving this as the first solid communication from Sri Aurobindo since he He stepped away on the 24th of November in 1926, just a few months earlier. That now he comes forward and he delivers this message asking for surrender to the light. He is not demanding personal loyalty to Mother and Sri Aurobindo. He's asking them to be what he is, an open vessel, completely given, and that this is the condition for the work in this yoga, this integral yoga. So when we permit from laxity some element of our being not to turn towards the light, then in a sense we've fallen out of tune with that high-pitched demand. But that's simply being human. There's more. If behind your devotion and surrender, you make a cover for your desires, egoistic demands, and vital insistences, if you put these things in place of the true aspiration or mix them with it and try to impose them on the divine Shakti, then it is idle to invoke the divine grace to transform you. We set the conditions with our self-giving for the grace to act. So there's an implicit agreement that we have with the divine that our aspiration is such that we're not comfortable with living the ordinary life anymore, but we want to be in mind, in heart, in the attunement of our vital instrument, in the very flesh, part of that expression. So that there could remain an insistence on ego or on gratifications which are natural to us places a distance between us and the divine. Now, does the divine demand that we be joyless or that we have no light, no play in our lives? Quite the contrary. But it is the separation, it is the ignorance that we have to step away from. We don't have to step away from life. We don't have to step away from our material sheaths. We don't have to be pure in an ivory tower. But we have to be true. We have to be sincere. This idea about a grace that responds to the offered soul, to the offered being, is part of the entire tantric tradition as well, going back 1,000 years, 1,400 years. We'll probably have occasion to come back to it again, but in the Malini Vijaya Uttara Tantra, grace is described as being essential for the change of consciousness, for the divination of the being. Nothing can occur if that grace does not descend. And that grace is defined variously, but in that particular tantra, it's defined as anugraha. It is that which comes and grasps you, that takes hold of you. And it cannot take hold of you if you haven't prepared yourself for it, because you would shatter under its force. So this offering and the purification that it entails is what strengthens the being and makes it capable of holding within it an infinite consciousness, an unwalled power. He continues, if you open yourself on one side or in one part to the truth, and on another side are constantly opening the gates to hostile forces, it is vain to expect that the divine grace will abide with you. You must keep the temple clean if you wish to install there the living presence. Sri Aurobindo has already described that it is the supramental calling from below and descending from above that affects this change, this transformation. One and the same presence, one involved in nature, one fully conscient, descending from above. Again, in the Tantra, it is the purity that the sadhak, that the seeker, establishes in the nature that bridges what we experience subjectively when we feel the onrush of this divine descent into the body. It's instantiation in the body that it becomes coincident, that it merges into the body, is essential to the fulfillment of tantric yoga. And even though Sri Aurobindo had never studied tantra to this extent, it's true in his practice as well. It is remarkable that Sri Aurobindo, without being given introduction to the deepest teachings of the tantra, understood them in a sense intuitively, automatically, by the dint of his own experience, which was not simply transcendent or deep, but was also wide. He continues, if each time the power intervenes and brings in the truth, you turn your back on it and call in again the falsehood that has been expelled, it is not the divine grace that you must blame for failing you, but the falsity of your own will and the imperfection of your own surrender. So you could conclude from this that Sri Aurobindo is looking at the congeries of personalities that have gathered there in the ashram at this point and surveying them and seeing some element of disunity beginning to rise, some discontent in the ashram. But you have to remember that all the way back to when he was first establishing the collective in Pondicherry, back to 1910, he's been working with many of these people, lifting their consciousness, working with the mother so that she can install her guidance in their lives. The idea of calling in again the falsehood, see, now we're moving back from the simple gravid condition of the human where we fall back to our old familiar nature. When you're calling in the falsehood, that means you've made a deliberate choice to stand apart from the light, apart from a unifying truth, and you're insisting on your separate satisfaction, on your separate greatness. This was something that Sri Aurobindo and Mother had to deal with Paul Richard. If you looked at her occasional commentary about that, again and again, the call in Richard, her then husband, for the return of a darkness which gave him some kind of sense of power, of greatness, was thrown out again and again and again by her at his request. She interceded on his behalf and took the darkness and eliminated it. But he felt bored. He didn't feel great anymore. He wasn't content to be a human, aspiring, waiting for that to come. He would call it back. Finally, she said, even when they were still in Japan, I'm done. I'm finished with it. Deal with it yourself. And you know the rest of the story. He couldn't deal with it. So they've had plenty of experience with this, not simply with Richard, but with others who joined and then left that budding ashram. And so he's trying to be very direct to say that if you want this to happen, you have to take a close look. The falsity of your own will. He continues, if you call for the truth, and yet something in you chooses what is false, ignorant, and undivine, or even simply is unwilling to reject it altogether, then always you will be open to attack, and the grace will recede from you. Detect first what is false or obscure in you and persistently reject it. Then alone can you rightly call for the divine power to transform you. This is part of our actual offering. This is part of what we bring as a gift to the divine, which is to take a straight look at our nature. Nobody's nature is in a perfect condition. We've accepted the body in order to challenge the material, the vitality, the illumination of the mind, and rework all of it in terms of a divine truth. That's why we've come here. That's our mission. So we don't have to look at our imperfections as something that, oh, we've got to tightly protect and keep this away from this descending light. Rather, we should be offering it in fullness. The transformation must be integral. So in other words, the entirety of the being. There's a letter that occurs a little bit later in this volume in which they're citing the reason for their embodiment, and it's worth reading here. 6 December 1930, just a couple of years later. So these themes are still alive in the ashram atmosphere. The supramental creation, since it is to be a creation upon earth, must be not only an inner change, but a physical and external manifestation also. And it is precisely for this part of the work, the most difficult of all, that surrender is most needful. For this reason, that it is the actual descent of the supramental divine into matter and the working of the divine presence and power there that can alone make the physical and external change possible. Even the most powerful self-assertion of human will and endeavor is impotent to bring it about. As for egoistic insistence and vital revolt, they are, so long as they last, insuperable obstacles to the descent. Only a calm, pure, and surrendered physical consciousness, full of the psychic aspiration, can be its field. This alone can make an effective opening of the material being to the light and power and the supramental change a thing actual and practicable. It is for this that we are here in the body, and it is for this that you and other sadhaks are in the ashram near us. But it is not by insistence on petty demands and satisfactions in the external field, or on an outer nearness pleasing to the vital nature and its pride or desire, then you can get the true relation with the divine in this province. If you want the realization there, it is the true nearness that you must seek, the descent and presence of the mother in your physical consciousness, her constant inner touch in the physical being and its activities, her will and knowledge behind all its work and thought and movement, and the ever-present ananda of that presence, expelling all vital and physical separateness, craving, and desire. If you have that, then you have all the nearness you can ask for, and all the rest you will gladly leave to the mother's knowledge and will to decide. For with this in you, there can be no feeling of being kept away, no sense of gulf and distance, no complaint of a unity that is lacking, or an empty dryness and denial of nearness. So the typical complaint of the human that if I don't get to see you every day, if you don't give me these nice things, then that proves that you don't love me and I'm not really wanted here. But there were great upasakas, great sadhaks who were there in the ashram, and we've mentioned one just last week, Sri T.V. Kapali Shastriya. That siddha in the line of Tantra, who had very few questions to pose to Sri Aurobindo in writing, very little that he felt the need to ask Mother verbally, but having received their instruction, took it inside, practiced it, realized it, even though he was two or three blocks away from the ashram, a great distance. He never left her consciousness, never left her true being. And this is the truth of the inner experience, and it impressed itself on his physical being so much that those who came to see him, when he wasn't wearing the upper cloth, and you could see his bare chest, saw a great red glow right here in the center part of his being, because the psychic fire in him was so powerful that it made an impression on the very physical body. So it is possible to achieve these states of being, which then summon from above this divine descent. A step at a time, one step, one part of the nature, observe what's going on, and have a will to change it. Reject the false notion that the divine power will do and is bound to do everything for you at your demand, and even though you do not satisfy the conditions laid down by the Supreme. Make your surrender true and complete. Then only will all else be done for you. True and complete. So, the inner offering, samarpana, has to be made all the way out to the physical being. We were observing last week that the practice of the inner yoga has finally to express itself in the physical. So the rite, R-I-T-E, is not wrong if it is filled with an inner consciousness and a living experience. Whatever you do becomes a rite, an expression of your communion with the divine. Reject, too, the false and indolent expectation that the divine power will do even the surrender for you. The Supreme demands your surrender to her, but does not impose it. You are free at every moment till the irrevocable transformation comes to deny and to reject the divine or to recall your self-giving, if you are willing to suffer the spiritual consequence. Your surrender must be self-made and free. It must be the surrender of a living being, not of an inert automaton or mechanical tool. So, that kind of passive surrender Sri Aurobindo deals with in so many letters on yoga. We needn't take it up here. Of course, the striking phrase is, the Supreme demands your surrender to her. She is not other than, she is not an executrix for some supreme male divinity. She is the Supreme. An inert passivity is constantly confused with a real surrender. But out of an inert passivity, nothing true and powerful can come. It is the inert passivity of physical nature that leaves it at the mercy of every obscure or undivine influence. A glad and strong and helpful submission is demanded to the working of the divine force. The obedience of the illumined disciple of the truth, of the inner warrior who fights against obscurity and falsehood, of the faithful servant of the divine. So you can't simply drift along, allowing nature to push you here or there, and expect for this change to come. A glad and strong and helpful submission. And look, it isn't that it is the soul that has to cleave to this light. The soul is alive and wants it, which is the source of your aspiration, no? The obedience of the illumined disciple of the truth, that's the mind. Illumined, which means the mind has to open itself and receive a light from above. The light of the superconscience, greater and greater ranges of it. And to cleave to and to choose that light, to become acclimatized to it, so that only that light should be in you. No darkness, no imperfection, no veil. Of the inner warrior who fights against obscurity and falsehood, this is the true vital nature coming forward, the great hero in all of us who stands for the truth, who is fearless, Abhaya, raises that hand and says, fear nothing. All will be well. It will meet whatever comes with a firm, unflinching resolve. In communion with the soul's force, with its own aspiration and surrender to the descending light. And then finally, the faithful servant of the divine. That is the body, your physical sheath, your well-meaning, beautiful physique, which wants the true, the good, the beautiful. Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram, auspicious, true, beautiful. This is what it wants to manifest. And it suffers the deviations of various parts of the nature, but it feels happiest when it's offered that gladdening light. This is the true attitude, and only those who can take and keep it preserve a faith unshaken by disappointments and difficulties, and shall pass through the ordeal to the supreme victory and the great transmutation. And again, what he's talking about here is the actual transformation of the body. This is 1927, and they were very much on pitch together, Mother and Sri Aurobindo, and with the collective body to move towards that. Sri Aurobindo has sounded a trumpet now. This is the first chapter of the book, The Mother. It wasn't given publication until 1928 with another five chapters. We'll take up chapter two next time. This faith unshaken is a knowledge instinct in the soul. It knows what beckons it, it knows what calls it, and it knows it cannot be turned back. So this idea that there is a supramental presence hidden in the body, which can arise to its full manifestation when the preparation has been made physically and vitally and mentally within us to receive the descending supramental power, is part of the secret of the sadhana. The aspiration of the soul is the central secret. That is where all of this meets and must find its congruence. So, chapter 2 next week. If you can permit a passage from Savitri, this is book 2, the book of the traveler of the worlds, canto 11, the kingdoms and godheads of the greater mind. A new beginning flowers in word and laugh. A new charm brings back the old extreme delight. He is lost in her. She is his heaven here. Truth smiled upon the gracious golden game. Out of her hushed eternal spaces leaned the great and boundless goddess, fain to yield the sunlit sweetness of her secrecies. Incarnating her beauty in his clasp, she gave for a brief kiss her immortal lips and drew to her bosom one glorified mortal head. She made earth her home, for whom heaven was too small. In a human breast her occult presence lived. He carved from his own self his figure of her. She shaped her body to a mind's embrace. Into thought's narrow limits she has come. Her greatness she has suffered to be pressed into the little cabin of the idea, the closed room of a lonely thinker's grasp. She has lowered her heights to the stature of our souls and dazzled our lids with her celestial gaze. Thus each is satisfied with his high gain and thinks himself beyond mortality blessed, a king of truth upon his separate throne. To her, possessor in the field of time, a single splendor caught from her glory seems the one true light, her beauty's glowing whole. But thought nor word can seize eternal truth. The whole world lives in a lonely ray of her sun. In our thinking's close and narrow lamplit house, the vanity of our shut mortal mind dreams that the chains of thought have made her ours. But only we play with our own brilliant bonds. Tying her down, it is ourselves we tie. In our hypnosis, by one luminous point, we see not what small figure of her we hold. We feel not her inspiring boundlessness. We share not her immortal liberty. Thus is it even with the seer and sage, for still the human limits the divine. Out of our thoughts we must leap up to sight, breathe her divine illimitable air, her simple vast supremacy confess, dare to surrender to her absolute. Then the unmanifest reflects his form in the still mind as in a living glass. The timeless ray descends into our hearts, and we are wrapped into eternity. For truth is wider, greater than her forms. 1,000 icons they have made of her, and find her in the idols they adore. But she remains herself and infinite. End of Canto 11. So, namaste. Jai Ma.